Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Stephen Miller, the Trump aide known as the architect of the former president's anti-immigrant policies, is reviving his cultural crusade as the head of a new activist legal group. America First Legal is a conservative nonprofit with disdain for the radical left and a wide-ranging plan to challenge the Biden administration in court. The group has already scored some early victories, including in lawsuits accusing the federal government of discriminating against white business owners. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Eric Larson. Tell us who Stephen Miller is for those who may not know.
So Stephen Miller is a conservative political operative who served as a senior White House aide to Donald Trump and also was a speechwriter for the president. He is known as the architect of some of Trump's most anti-immigrant policies, things like the Muslim ban and the family separation policies, and some of those really divisive policies that really riled up a lot of Democrats.
Did he start America First Legal?
He did. It was just started in April. He did so with the blessing of Donald Trump, who issued a press release praising his effort and the opening of America First Legal. So he's leading it. And he's doing so with several other former Trump administration officials who've joined him in the effort, including former acting U.S. Attorney General Whitaker and some other folks.
He's not a lawyer, right?
No, he's not a lawyer. But he has a former Justice Department lawyer during the Trump administration, Gene Hamilton, who was known for working on a lot of immigration policies under Trump, is one of the lead lawyers at America First Legal.
So there are established right-wing legal advocacy groups such as Alliance Defending Freedom and Judicial Watch. So why another group?
Well, that's a good question. Some folks that I spoke with in the conservative nonprofit group there said that even though there are these other groups, that they still feel like they're outgunned by left-leaning organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union. You know, they want to see something that rises to that level. Even though America First Legal has just started earlier this year, that's how they kind of already want to be seen, as really going after the Biden administration on a range of policies, the same way that the ACLU did during the Trump administration.
So what are some of the aims, or maybe I should say targets, of the group?
They're pretty wide-ranging. It started out with lawsuits against the administration challenging racial equity programs that had been built into the pandemic relief bill that had earmarked billions of dollars to be prioritized toward minority-owned restaurants in one provision and minority-owned farms and ranches in another. And he filed separate lawsuits over both of those, and actually won injunctions, preliminary injunctions against the administration in those cases, which are still pending. But he's also sued over the Biden administration's return to policies that ban discrimination against people based on sexual orientation or gender identity in healthcare and housing and the like. And, you know, that's just the beginning. There are several other aspects of the administration that he seems to be eyeing based on the press releases they've been putting out and the Freedom of Information Act requests that they've been filing and highlighting on their website.
You said they have scored victories. These are cases where they can pick the judge or at least the courthouse that will be hearing the case?
Yes, they've been filing suits in Texas where they can, but also in Washington, D.C. federal court. In the two cases where they did get these preliminary injunctions granted, those were in Texas. It was a Republican-appointed judge who did that. But not all of their cases are before Republican-appointed judges, but so far they've had pretty good luck with those in the suits they have filed in Texas. Another case where they didn't get an injunction, but they did get a preliminary ruling where the judge, seemed to praise or side with what they were saying about the Biden administration's handling of undocumented migrant children at the border. That was another one of the first lawsuits that ASL filed, accusing the Biden administration of allowing undocumented migrant children into housing in the U.S., even though they might have COVID-19, was his argument that it was a health violation. And the judge in that case said he agreed essentially with that case.
In that case, did they do it in conjunction with the Texas Attorney General?
They did. And the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, a very outspoken Republican, of course, who has challenged Biden on a range of issues and is very critical of the administration on his own right, filed that lawsuit. It challenges provisions of the Migrant Protection Protocol, which was a Trump policy that Biden tried to walk away from and is having trouble doing so. And so AFL, one of their first clients was the state of Texas, which in a way isn't too surprising because they're extremely ideologically aligned.
Eric, tell us more about Miller's suit challenging pandemic aid earmarked for minority-owned farms.
America First Legal filed a couple of lawsuits over provisions of the massive stimulus bill passed by Congress. It included a few equity programs in it that tried to essentially right some wrongs that had been done previously by prioritizing some money for minority-owned restaurants as well as minority-owned farms and ranches. And in these two lawsuits, Stephen Miller's group claims that it's discrimination, racial discrimination against white people that he says is banned by the Civil Rights Act, which is kind of interesting that the complaint itself was actually fairly short, but it included some language and references that you would normally see in a suit alleging racial discrimination against racial minorities. So it's kind of turning it around and using it sort of against these minorities' interests, which really wasn't lost on the people, some of the people who I interviewed for the story. I interviewed John Boyd, he's the president and founder of the National Black Farmers Association. He filed a motion to intervene in one of those cases, and he won that permission. And he says that it's just flat out discrimination. That the real discrimination here is with Stephen Miller's lawsuit. They're trying to pretend that there was never any discrimination in the past, and therefore there should be no measures taken now to fix it in the present.
Did AFL respond to this? I see that their website says it's committed to fighting for all Americans, regardless of race, color, religion, or creed.
That's correct. I included that in my story because, unfortunately, they didn't respond to repeated requests for comments. I reached out to them numerous times by phone and email, also to their PR firm, and they just didn't respond, although they do make regular appearances on Fox News and Newsmax and OAN, where they spread this message. And, of course, we have to remember that this is a nonprofit, and they're actively raising money at all times.
Do most of their cases focus on immigration?
I really don't think so. I think that is an obvious interest of Stephen Miller, and they do have one or two cases related to that. But really, they're looking at the whole universe of conservative concerns, gender identity, LGBT rights, even critical race theory, some of the Freedom of Information Act requests that they've filed are demanding, information from the Biden administration about why they stopped investigating the source of COVID-19. They even sued Biden for forcing Russ Vought off of that naval board. And he's a member of AFL, one of the directors. So there's really just a really wide range of legal issues that they're looking at here, and it's not just immigration.
Do we know how much funding they have and who is funding them?
We don't. You know, I would have definitely loved to have asked them that question to find out. But it's too early. They're too new to have any filings. So we really just have no way of knowing, unfortunately.
Because for a new organization, they seem to have a lot of litigation going on.
Right. I mean, anything is possible. Of course, we know one person who has plenty of money. That's Donald Trump. They always could have gotten some from him, but that's just speculation. But they are doing a lot of real work, and that does cost a lot of money. So one can assume that they at least have something that they started out with.
Is Trump a visible supporter of the group?
He is, only in that their very first press release that went out in April quoted President Trump, praising Stephen Miller by name and saying that the left was outfunding us in courts, us being the right, and that we needed something like AFL to counter that movement and to take the Biden administration to court. Trump spelled that all out and said that Stephen Miller was the guy to do it.
You write that prevailing in court might not be the primary reason for the group.
Yeah, that was one theory from someone I spoke with. They see the names involved. They see there's quite a bit of evidence of people in Trump's orbit, sort of now that he's out of office, finding ways to sort of cash in using his name and tapping into his huge support. He has millions of supporters all around the country, and a lot of them are very angry, and a lot of them really despise the left. And if you say the right things, do the right things, you can really capture their attention and get them to open their wallets. So there's some cynicism around that, of course. They probably would say the same thing about people on the left and the ACLU.
Do you get any sense that what they're doing, the cases that they're bringing, are any different from those of Alliance Defending Freedom or Judicial Watch?
I would say that they seem to be signaling that they're going to be a lot more active than those groups, and that they're going to be looking at a much wider range of issues, and that they're going to be really focused on the issues that in particular really seem to concern the farther right individuals. So whereas you might see some of those more established groups might be focusing more on different policies that maybe aren't quite so controversial, I don't think that's going to be a concern of AFL.
So did anyone you spoke to think that this was a short-term endeavor that possibly it won't last past 2024 when Trump will decide whether or not to run?
Someone I spoke to said that it's possible that they're just looking for, a paycheck and waiting to see what happens in 2024. And maybe they'll be, back in power and get bigger jobs in the administration or something like that. But even if they were able to do that, even if Stephen Miller, made a triumphant return to the White House, I wouldn't be surprised if they found some way to keep America First Legal, still going and doing what it does. But right now they need a boogeyman, and that's Biden, and he's in office. If that changes, who knows?
It seems like their cases are anti-abortion, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ, that they're fighting against other people's rights.
That's the big difference between what the ACLU did and what America First Legal is doing. Of course, the ACLU was raising the alarm about concerns that rights would be taken away. And in fact, that was the case. That is what the Trump administration tried to do. AFL is focused on the concerns of really mostly, white people, straight white men in particular. That seems to be their focus.
Thanks, Eric. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Eric Larson.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, We don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It made headlines when Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman were arrested in 2019 boarding a plane with one-way tickets to Europe. Prosecutors claimed the pair had made donations to American politicians to advance the interests of Ukrainian officials. Now Fruman has pleaded guilty, and Parnas' trial seems to have morphed into something different altogether. The government's case has almost nothing to do with Ukraine and instead focuses on political contributions allegedly intended to help launch a cannabis business. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Christian Berthelsen. So, Christian, tell us what charges Parnas is facing at trial.
Yeah, so that's a strange one. Lev Parnas and his business associate, Igor Fruman, were charged 2 years ago. And, you know, they were involved in Rudy Giuliani's efforts to dig up dirt on Joe Biden in Ukraine. And this was sort of a subtext to the whole first impeachment trial of Donald Trump and the quid pro quo he was seeking in Ukraine to get damaging information about the Bidens prior to the election. Lev and Igor were working with Giuliani to try and facilitate that. They were actually arrested with one-way tickets to leave the country, getting on an airplane in Washington, D.C. The government alleged that they had been working for Ukrainian officials to advance their interests in the United States and that they played a role in the firing of the then U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. All of those allegations were then sort of quietly dropped from the case about a year ago. Mr. Fruman pleaded guilty. Mr. Parnas just started trial yesterday, but the charges against him now involve allegedly illegal campaign donations he made to try and advance a cannabis business in Nevada, California, and elsewhere. So it's a very different case than what prosecutors said it was when they charged it 2 years ago.
Is Fruman going to testify for the prosecution?
No. So two of the defendants in that case, there were four defendants. Two of them have pleaded guilty. Neither one of them pleaded guilty with a cooperation agreement. So they are not expected to become government witnesses.
During the trial, is there going to be a lot of mention of former President Trump or Rudy Giuliani?
One would have thought that, given the way the case was charged 2 years ago. But no, as we get toward trial, one of the prosecutors told the judge last week that Mr. Trump and Mr. Giuliani are going to be peripheral figures at best.
Do you know why this case took such a turn?
The prosecutors, when they dropped that allegation from the case, offered no explanation as to why they were doing it. They said they were streamlining certain factual assertions, and they left it at that. And they have declined to say anything beyond that. So that is really not much of an answer and sort of leaves it open to speculation as to why. you know, they do have the evidence in the campaign finance charges, and that's an easier case to bring. And potentially what they could have done is sort of just wanted to charge and try an easier case rather than getting into issues that the defense could have raised about, you know, doing something in, on behalf of the president and whether that then became acceptable. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows outside of the office why they decided to do it that way.
And what's Parnas's defense?
So the campaign charges involve funds that came from a Russian investor in the cannabis business and that were then used to donate to certain state politicians around the country. His defense is that there was no conspiracy to do that, and the funds that were donated did not come from the Russian businessman.
There are two defendants. Are their defenses united? Are they working together?
They're actually not working together, which has been an interesting development and only become clear in the last week or so, that the other defendant, Andrei Kukushkin, basically says that he was a victim of Lev Parnas and that this entire scheme with the campaign donations was really just a scheme to get money out of Mr. Kukushkin and his Russian investor. And in fact, of the $1 million that came from Russia, a little over 100,000 of it actually was donated to politicians. The rest was diverted to other purposes.
Let's turn to one of the witnesses who will testify at the trial. Adam Laxalt, who's running for U.S. Senate in Nevada, I believe. So why is he testifying at this trial?
That's correct. He's expected to testify today. He's kind of an interesting figure because he was attorney general and running for governor of Nevada when he received donations from Mr. Parnas. And he, of course, then went on to become a co-chair of Trump's reelection campaign in Nevada and fanned a lot of the voter fraud allegations that Mr. Trump was making in an effort to overturn the results in Nevada. The prosecutors have asked the judge to keep the questioning away from that issue. But the defense wants to raise it because they think it goes to his credibility as a witness.
Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, I'll continue this conversation with Bloomberg legal reporter Christian Berthelsen. And we'll talk about the new U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York.
You're listening to Bloomberg Law with June Grasso from Bloomberg Radio.
The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York is the most high-profile of the 93 offices around the country. Known for policing Wall Street and prosecuting high-profile cases involving terrorism, organized crime, and public corruption. Damian Williams is the first black person to be in charge of the Southern District in its 232-year history and one of the youngest. I've been talking to Bloomberg legal reporter Christian Berthelsen. So tell us about his background.
Well, let's see. He's born in New York City, grew up in Atlanta. His parents are immigrants. He's quite a success story, Harvard undergrad, Yale Law School, clerked for Merrick Garland on the D.C. Appeals Court. And Merrick Garland is, of course, now the attorney general. He has been a U.S. attorney for about 10 years and was elevated first from being a line prosecutor to the co-chief of the securities unit, and from there to head of the entire office as of last week, confirmed by the Senate after being nominated earlier this year by President Biden.
Would you say that he's been the star of the U.S. Attorney's Office?
Certainly. I mean, you know, the Southern District U.S. Attorney's Office has a reputation as being sort of one of the most elite offices in the country, partially because of, you know, being here in New York and being sort of the law enforcement overseer of Wall Street. And within the office, the securities unit is viewed as sort of the most high-profile unit. So Mr. Williams was a line prosecutor in the unit following the financial crisis and did some of the office's most high-profile cases. They included the conviction of the guilty plea of a sitting U.S. congressman for insider trading, other cases against hedge funds for insider trading and mismarking, other forms of securities fraud, and another big case involving circulation of non-public, highly sensitive information from government agencies to hedge funds that informed their trading ahead of major decision announcements.
So he's taking over at a time when there's been some controversies.
Yes. Well, you know, the past 4 years under the Trump administration were challenging for the Southern District. They included the unceremonious firings of two U.S. attorneys during that period and, you know, a fair amount of meddling from main justice in the affairs of the Southern District, the pardoning of defendants who were convicted by this office, including Steve Bannon, Mr. Trump's sometimes political advisor. And there have also been missteps by the office itself. There have been multiple cases in recent years where the office was found to have withheld important, potentially exculpatory information from defense lawyers for defendants that were being prosecuted by the office. And it has been castigated by judges in this district for not playing fair. So there is a fair amount of work to do in rebuilding the reputation of this office, both with the public and with the judges who oversee the cases they bring.
Is he stepping into a role in an office where there's a morale problem?
Yes. People who have left the office say that the lawyers who are there have been having morale issues, partly, you know, the same way everyone has with this pandemic and through remote work. But the hits to the office's reputation from the evidentiary issues, everyone has taken hard. And the meddling that came from the Trump administration has also weighed on morale there. So, yes, you know, people say that the new U.S. attorney has a fair amount of work to do in trying to restore that office to its prior heights.
The Southern District, known for prosecuting Wall Street crimes, financial securities fraud, during the Trump administration, those crimes were not given the same attention. Any indication what he's going to focus on?
Not really. You know, there's no public hearings for U.S. attorney nominees, so he hasn't had any kind of public airing of, you know, his record or what he sees as the office's mission. You know, obviously he has been talking to former leaders of the office, former senior officials there, friends, colleagues, in the months since his nomination, as he sort of puts together ideas for how he wants to lead and what he wants to focus on. But the people who have had those conversations with him have not wanted to go into great detail about them and feel like he should be given room to set those priorities and announce those things himself. He just started in the job on Sunday, so he hasn't himself held any public events yet to articulate that either.
Tell us what high-profile cases there are in the office right now that he's going to be overseeing.
Well, as you were saying, enforcement of white-collar financial-type crimes did fall precipitously during the Trump administration. Part of that is because, you know, those types of cases tend to come up when you have downturns in the market or downturns in the economy, and that hasn't been the case in the last 4 years. So there is a bit of a cyclical ebb to it. However, you could also infer that it just was not a priority of the prior administration to bring those kinds of cases. So I think you could expect to see an effort to bring more of those. You know, this office works particularly closely with the SEC, and Gary Gensler, the new SEC chief, has identified areas that he sees as ripe for greater enforcement. One thing that he is focused on is insider trading by corporate executives outside of established 10b5 plans where CEOs have pre-established plans to sell equity that they accumulate in their companies. But you'll occasionally see them either changing their plans or trading outside of their plans. And sometimes if that is time to market moving information, that's something the SEC wants to focus on more. And typically the way that works is that, you know, the SEC will bring its strongest cases where there is evidence of criminality to the Southern District, and they do those cases jointly. So you could expect to see cases like that. So the ones that are in the works, Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's alleged wrangler of underage girls, that's charged and is coming to trial this fall. There was a recently charged case, a corporate case, involving an electric vehicle company and whether that was misrepresenting its results to the market. But there is kind of a dearth right now in big cases with a lot of public attention to them.
Thanks, Christian. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Christian Berthelsen.
And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to join us weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time for the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.